is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, September 26, 2025. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, the theme was Off the Hill, Parliament's Back in Session. Our panel featured Ontario Federation of Labour President Laura Walton, former Ontario NDP MPP and former federal NDP candidate Joel Hardin, researcher and activist Chuka Ijekum, and Rabble's own parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg. Here is a small clip from last week's panel. Take a listen.
Now, to get us started this evening, the House of Commons has returned to sitting as of yesterday, September 15th. This past summer, we saw the passage of Bill C-5 in June, a legislation that greatly expanded the government's ability to fast-track so-called economic development projects, but it also set aside some key requirements to consult with Indigenous communities where these projects may be happening. This summer also saw the Air Canada flight attendants stand up against unpaid labour and for fair wages. This even despite the government interfering again with the union's right to bargain with their employer. And of course, as I mentioned, there was the beginning of the leadership race for the federal NDP, which kicked off at the start of this month. So to begin, let's lay the groundwork. Carl, let's go to you first. I'd like to ask you first off, what are some of the priorities you see on the agenda for this new parliamentary session?
Well, the big priority for the government is to finally put together a coherent economic plan that will finally come into budget that they're forcing as late as possible. They're looking at a complicated balancing act because Carney has wanted to cut taxes for kind of old-fashioned populist reasons. Well, he cut the consumer carbon tax, which was supposed to be revenue neutral. And let's assume maybe that it was revenue neutral, so they're not necessarily losing revenue from getting rid of the consumer carbon tax. But they also cut a tax increase that was supposed to have come into effect in the spring called the, it's complicated to explain. It was changing or partially increasing the inclusion rate of something called the capital gains tax. And if I explain that, that would be over the panel. So but what it is essentially, it is a form of tax generally on wealth and on wealthy people. Let's put it that way. It's not a wealth tax, but it essentially targets a very small minority of very wealthy people. Chrystia Freeland, who resigned yet again today from politics. This is her favorite hobby, resigning from politics. At the time she was the finance minister, said, well, there's only about a small proportion of 1% of Canadians who would pay more tax, but it would bring in a lot of revenue. So he cut that. He also cut a tax. He cut the marginal rate at the lowest level. So he cut so all of us who pay taxes, we pay X amount for our first $30,000. Then we pay for the second tranche of income, a higher amount, and then a yet higher amount for the third and fourth. So he cut it for the first part. That means that everybody who pays taxes gets a break on the first tranche of their income, even if they have more. Of course, some people only have that much. And people who are really, and many, many people who are in the situation of dire poverty and of extreme need who don't actually pay taxes get nothing. So it is a kind of a masquerade populist thing saying it's going to give the average family $840 and it's going to give people who the middle class, they love to talk about that and help them out. It doesn't really help out the people who need it most. It doesn't help anybody with true social needs. It is just, again, a kind of cheap populist gimmick, which Carney did because the Conservatives promised to cut taxes even more. So now he's facing less money. He's taking less money based on the tax system, but He is promising to vastly, monumentally increase military spending like we have never done since World War II. An enormous amount and a good thing. That's, I would say, a very dubious idea. A good thing, he is promising for the first time since the Liberals cut this in the 1990s to plow federal money into housing, seriously. So those are two areas that he's going to spend, and he has a few other priorities. And somehow he's talking about restraining spending and being responsible and not going too deeply into debt. And how he's going to do that, it's going to be sort of like Houdini getting out of chains while he's underwater. You know, he claims that he's not going to have to cut the public service or public services, that he'll just cut the public service by attrition.
Right.
It is magic. I mean, the tragedy for, and we'll see, maybe they'll change their minds. People like your friends, of my friend and the friend of many people here, Linda McQuaig, say, well, this is the time. They don't want to do a capital gains tax, which had all kinds of side effects and which would may have hurt some people sort of unintentionally who we didn't want to aim for. How about a wealth tax? Take fortunes over $25, $30, $40 million a year and tax the wealth above that. That'll affect no middle-class person. What middle-class person has a total net worth of $25 million or $30 million? But they're not going to do that. I doubt they'll do that. So look for a very, very complicated challenge when they come to the budget in November.
All right. Thank you very much, Carl. And Chuka, I just wanted to go to you now. How do you feel about this new session of Parliament and the direction that Mark Carney is taking the country?
I think, of course, the direction Carney's taking the country is quite atrocious. It seems he's intent on not ever being outflanked on the right, regardless of whether it's within his party or within an election. I don't think that that's good. I find it additionally offensive, given he became prime minister without having to face a popular election. He only faced an intra-party election. But, you know, one thing that I think would be important, though I don't expect to see, is the government working to decouple Canada's fate from that of the U.S. I think in a number of ways, U.S. policy is increasingly disturbing. You know, it's difficult to imagine the U.S. government becoming even more overtly lawless and fascist, but here we are. But I think there are a number of things that will be immensely costly or harmful for Canada and Canadians. Carl mentioned the defense spending that Carney's already committed to. We, of course, can't ignore this absurd Golden Dome project that the U.S. president has talked about, sort of a missile defense array for North America, because, of course, we endure many international ballistic missile strikes. I think as well the change to vaccine regulation and mandates in the United States also is going to have significant implications for public health. So does that create different considerations for Canada regarding cross-border travel and things like that? And then finally, I think the U.S. will increasingly require its allies to be equally as lawless. Murders, the absolute unlawful murders that the U.S. is carrying out against, you know, just people in boats, right? Like, we don't know who they are. We don't know what they're doing. They're just killing people in boats. So I think the U.S. is increasingly going to demand its partners participate in those actions. And I think that's that, obviously, I think that that is a bad thing.
Thank you so much, Chuka. We've heard a bit about kind of priorities for people more broadly. I wanted to bring this question to Laura now. Could you kind of give us insight into what the priorities are, specifically from a labor perspective?
You know, I think from a labor perspective, it's about what do workers need? I think, you know, this past federal election, even the past provincial election, it was completely under the shadow of, you know, what I lovingly call the mango menace to the South. And, you know, the things that he was threatening to do, going to be doing, in labor, we've been watching our siblings to the South, where they're dealing with right to work legislation, where they're dealing with absolute, like, regressive legislation, where it's removing the right to bargain from some folks where they've got complete and utter gutting of public services and funding of public services. All of these things have impacts on workers, if not directly, but also indirectly, whether it be a family member or from services that you're receiving. And, you know, it's not a day goes by that you aren't able to turn on social media or turn on something and you're listening to a worker down in the States saying, but I didn't know. I didn't know that it was going to be me. And so I think from a labor perspective up here, we're saying, yeah, it is us. It is us. And I think, you know, it's not lost on us that like one of the first major things that Carney did after he, you know, went around with his elbows up or down or whatever he's doing, you know, was to put in and, you know, use Section 107 within 7 hours of flight attendants going on strike. We have grounded planes in Toronto for longer than 7 hours because of snow. Like, let's be clear. So it's not like the world is coming to a big sudden halt because of this. And so I think, you know, from a labor perspective, we need to see the government. And I say this for every political party. We need to see the government centering workers in the fight. Without workers, there is no economy, whether that be provincially or federally. It is workers that make this go around. And if we aren't going to center workers and their needs in the fight, you know, I'm telling you, I expect that we're seeing the revolution. We're seeing the revolution start. And what's interesting is it's being led by women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Laura. Jumping into the topic of the NDP leadership race, something that we're covering eagerly here as a team at Rabble. Joel, I wanted to go to you and ask you, what are your thoughts on the race so far?
Well, full disclosure off the top, Nick, I am involved in a leadership campaign that hasn't officially launched yet, so I'm going to let that campaign do that. But I'm a New Democrat that very much cares about the future of our federal party, and I know I'm not alone. I'm also a Canadian who believes that having a third party, at least for the English-speaking world, predominantly in the English-speaking, having a third party, we also have the Greens, we have the Bloc, having these other options for Canadians is critical. Because what we've seen at the House of Commons with the NDP absent from committees is the Liberals not even having a guardrail, not even thinking about worrying about their left caucus in their own party. Bill C-2, information sharing with the Trump administration on highly sensitive things. Bill C-5, initially at least, a full challenge to the sovereignty of Indigenous peoples deciding about what goes through their lands. We have seen cuts to the federal public service here in the city of Ottawa, the biggest employer. We're talking about upwards of 28,000 jobs lost in the next 2 years. And when folks call Canada Revenue Agency about their taxes, or if they're bringing over loved ones in family reunification through Immigration Refugee Canada services, or if they're trying to get EI benefits, you're talking to a chatbot. That's the Mark Carney legacy. He was promising people elbows up for Trump. Frankly, all I've seen is a guy who very successfully stole a lot of the left vote. He's now involved in stealing a lot of the right vote. And to my mind, he's prepping the ground for major companies to come into our economy even more and take a huge role, whether it's the high-speed rail project from Quebec to Windsor, which apparently we have to study now for an additional 5 years after it's been studied for 10 years and work through a public-private partnership, whether it's his promises on housing, which is all about for-profit, to my mind, at least at this point, not clearly transparent contracts with developers who at this point, in my community, at least here in Ottawa, we are building condos that are too small for families and the people can't even frankly afford. We have a glut of condos in the Ottawa market. We know it's a problem in Toronto. So Carney is in full embrace of the corporate agenda, which is making life harder and harder for everyday folks here. So I am really excited to get into the leadership race so candidates can come forward and talk about real social democratic socialist solutions to these problems, because I think we really urgently need them.
Thank you so much, Joel. I want to bring the same question to Chuka now, kind of looking at it from a different angle. The NDP lost official party status during the last federal election. If the party hopes to regain status in the next election, what do you think they will need in a leader?
I think one thing is that the party needs a leader who has ideas for how to use the party if they're not in government, but two, even if they are never going to form government. Of course, I'm not saying that the NDP isn't ever going to form government, but they haven't yet. And if they don't hold the balance of power, right, if it's not a minority government and they don't hold the balance of power in terms of passing legislation, then the party still has to find ways to be influential because there are a lot of people for whom the NDP is basically the only choice. It's not a question of whether you vote for the Liberals or the NDP or the Conservatives or the NDP, even the Greens or the NDP. For a lot of people, it's do you vote for the NDP or do you not vote at all? And I think part of that is out of a, frankly, disgust for the world that has been created by the political system that we live in, the world that our political system continues to permit. And so I think someone who sees a role for the party in direct action, in organizing protests, in effectively being in the streets, I think that will, I think that could spark interest in people who don't see anybody to vote for in this country.
Now, Carl, I'd like to go back to you because you had a very interesting piece on the site last week about the importance of the next NDP leader being bilingual, the importance of bilingualism on the national stage. And I'd just like you to expand on that a little bit for our audience here tonight. And then afterwards, I'd like to give Joel a quick moment to respond before he has to head out at the top of the hour.
So I'll just say it very quickly that the main point that I made in my little piece is that the Liberals Conservatives decided a long time ago, the last time the Liberals had a leader who couldn't conduct himself in pretty good French and carry on a debate in French and be interviewed in French and overall sell his message in French was long before many of the people joining me here were born. I'll be honest, I'm 78 years old, so I'm not going to hide my age anymore. I was 21 years old, barely out of school. And that last prime minister was Lester Pearson, who retired in 1968. The Liberals haven't had a non-bilingual leader since 1968. The Conservatives took until 1976, and then that was it. Even when they were looking, the party that ultimately joined the Conservatives, the further right party, the Reform Party, looking for somebody to lead the party, to lead it into a merger, they chose Stephen Harper largely because he was bilingual. And I'd say that many of the national leadership of the Liberals and Conservatives, a good many of them, had made this decision that they're really going to bone up on their French, work on their French and be bilingual. I mean, a bunch of conservatives from Western Canada, including Stephen Harper, including Jason Kenney, including James Moore and many others, and from Ontario, people who had no natural connection to French, who didn't grow up speaking French, who don't have Francophone neighbors and don't live in a Francophone area, really put their muscle into it, put their brain power, put their energy into it, and said, I'm going to learn French. And many liberals, again, outside of Ottawa, Montreal, bilingual areas, similarly really decided, Chrystia Freeland being an example, she's retiring today, but many others, I am going to be able to function in French if I want to be part of the national leadership of this country. It doesn't mean every member of the cabinet has to, and some members of the cabinet don't speak English, in fact, although that's very, very rare. So I think the NDP has not got with the program. The NDP doesn't, if you don't, you know, a great leader named Alexa McDonough was not really bilingual. She was a wonderful leader. She was a great person. I knew her well. She was a leader in the late 90s. And in order to take part in a debate in French, she had to listen to the questions through a headset. Well, I mean, it's just embarrassing. In first place, I'm fluently bilingual and I can't code switch like that. Your brain isn't worked to function. Your brain isn't or engineered to listen to a question translated into English and then answer in French back and forth. It's like playing piano in the key of G in one hand, in the key of D in the other hand. I mean, it doesn't work. And so she just couldn't do it. And I asked the late Bill Blakeney, the son of the former premier of Saskatchewan, who was her press secretary at the time. I said, why do you bother? Why do you bother? I mean, she's just embarrassing herself. She's not really even able to answer the question at all. She can't really take part. She can't understand the question. She says, look, we're not going to win seats in Quebec by taking part, but there are many, many, what he called Canadian nationalists in Toronto, is how he put it, but elsewhere, who won't take you seriously if we don't take French seriously, who won't take our party seriously, who won't think our party deserves our vote or deserves their attention and their consideration. If we don't take seriously, then we have to communicate with all Canadians. French-speaking Canadians are 9 million people. That's a lot of people out of 40 million. And if you can't communicate with them, it's not that complicated. It's not that complicated to learn another language. It's pathetic, that sad and tragic that so many people in Canada make such a big bugbear out of it. I think it's mostly huge amounts of negative psychology that influences people. It's not that difficult. And I mean, I know people who learn five or six languages, and people who come to Canada speaking neither English or French, but off for economic and survival reasons, have to learn both in some cases do it. They do it because otherwise they can't eat. So I think you simply have to have a leader who has an NDP activist friend of mine said, well, I think Carney's set the bar lower for that. Yes, he set the bar lower, but he still takes part in debates in French, answers questions in the House in French, makes speeches in French. He spontaneously conducts himself in French, and his French gets better every day. The Francophones are still comment on the French media that his French is a little bit dubious, a little bit funny, but he still carries on, and it does get better, and he still works at it. And if he sets the bar lower, the NDP can't have a candidate who's any lower than him, because he's at the bottom. You cannot be worse than Carney and aspire to national leadership. That's as bad as you can be.
And just on that note, just before I go to Joel, I just want to acknowledge that Eve Engler, who has announced his candidacy for the NDP leadership race, he is Francophone.
He's Anglophone, actually. Eve Engler speaks French, but he's Anglophone.
He's Anglophone. He speaks French, which Andrew Glenn Cross...
With a very marked accent. I mean, he definitely does speak French, but it's okay. Accent is nothing. It's not that important. But I mean, he definitely speaks French, but not perfectly and fluently. His first name is a French first name, but he's comes from an Anglophone family.
All right. And I just wanted to acknowledge that because Andrew Glenn Cross was mentioning that in the chat. And Joel, now I just want to give you a chance to respond to Carl and respond to Chuka with your thoughts on what they said about the leadership race.
Well, first of all, just to begin with what Carl said, I live in a community where 30% of the people live here. French is their first language. And, you know, this is an absolutely crucial point that we have to be able to talk to 9 million Canadians for whom French is not just a language, it's a foundational part of their identity. Where I would bridge from what Carl said to what Chuka said is we also have to be thinking about leadership, not just embodied in the savior complex of one person. If they can articulately speak both official languages in Canada, will lead us to the promised land. We have a much better approach to leadership, I find, evolving on the left. I saw it in the flight attendant struggle, where if the work we do is grounded in grassroots experience, articulated from the heart, we can organize and take on any powerful foe. And that includes the Prime Minister of this country. That includes $1 billion executives at Air Canada. That includes the fight that Laura led against Doug Ford in 2022, when you were told you had to go back to work and a law was passed. And Laura, I was there in the chamber that day when there was QP colors all over, and Doug Ford and Stephen Lecce had to apologize to you, to the chamber, and take it back. That had to do with a cultural competency and a political competency of organizing, as Chuka was saying, at a grassroots level to get Canadians excited about politics again. Carl is right, though. We do have to have, absolutely do have to have, the ability to speak in French. Something I'll end with, and this will hopefully bridge into the conversation, Nick. And thinking about leadership, too, certainly if you look at the Sherbrooke Declaration that Jack Layton wrote on with other folks that Alexandre Bolaris and others have been promoting in the province of Quebec, we are increasingly thinking about how we promote a symbol of leadership in our party that's not just embodied in one person leading us to that wonderful Canadian future. We have to engage at a grassroots level.
Was a small clip from Rabble's most recent Off the Hill political panel. To watch the full recording, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with national politics. Workers are raising the alarm over proposed cuts to the Federal Ministry of Women and Gender Equality. The United Food and Commercial Workers Canada Union and other stakeholders released internal budget forecasting from the ministry earlier this week, which showed that the government planned to decrease spending by over 80% in the next 3 years. Programs provided by the ministry help support businesses run by women and members of the 2S LGBTQIA+ community, as well as providing funding to address systemic barriers to those same groups. The cuts are part of a government-wide initiative to reduce spending ordered by the Mark Carney Liberal government. As part of the cuts, the Ministry of Women and Gender Equality expects to reduce its number of full-time employees by nearly 200 in the next 3 years. Staying with national politics, the National Farmers Union issued a list of priorities they would like to see included in the fall Liberal budget. These priorities include increased funding for all food and agricultural regulators to ensure that they can effectively enforce regulations like proper food standards that are in the public interest. The National Farmers Union is also calling for revisions to Canada's temporary migrant worker programs and to immigration law and regulations to support full labor rights and a reliable pathway to permanent residency. In addition to the National Farmers Union, individuals are also circulating petitions submitted to Parliament calling for new regulations affecting agriculture, including a petition calling for the protection of the right for farmers to breed and keep their own seeds. Also this week, federal NDP leadership candidate Eve Engler argues that the party needs to embrace its socialist roots if it is to revitalize itself after its recent election defeat. In the April federal election, the NDP was reduced to just 7 seats in the House of Commons, losing official party status. Engler argues that whether on climate, income inequality, or access to social services, the NDP failed to attack the source of all of these issues, capitalism. Staying with coverage of the NDP leadership race, Avi Lewis announced his intention to enter the race at the end of last week. Lewis is a filmmaker and journalist who unsuccessfully ran for the NDP in Vancouver Centre in the recent federal election. His grandfather, David Lewis, was the leader of the federal NDP in the 1970s, and his father, Stephen Lewis, was the leader of the Ontario NDP at the same time. In a video announcing the launch of his campaign for the leadership, Lewis expressed his support for a public option for groceries, for mental health to be covered under the public health care system, as well as a tax on the wealthy. Lewis is the first candidate to be formally accepted by the NDP Leadership Committee. The first event of the leadership campaign will be a candidates forum on October 22nd. The leadership race will run until the party's convention in Winnipeg in March. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.